Welcome back. Just first, before we get started here, I'd like to make a quick announcement. We're trying to collect PowerPoints from those who have presented so far and those who are yet to present to include with the web-based presentation of conference recordings. If you have one that you are in a position to share with us, please see Kerry Janelle. He's got a thumb drive. He would be most grateful to get that from you. So this session is Disks and Cylinders. I understand that there's a need to give a title to these sessions, but that's really about as close as you can get to a miscellaneous section. This could potentially have been called, you know, the sound recording session, and I don't know that it would narrow it down a whole lot more than that. But we'll see along the way what really makes this distinctively about disks as disks and cylinders as cylinders. I believe there will be some connections to be made along the way that will make the session rise above a miscellaneous section. It gives me great pleasure to introduce this first group of speakers, a group of people I've had the pleasure of working with together on a number of projects, although this is one I've just been observing from a distance. David Giovannoni, who's known to many or all of you, a man who's had a hand in all kinds of interesting projects connected with early recorded sound, the person I dare say is singly most responsible for the fact we can listen to phonautograms today, and who is right here. Along with him, we'll have Rich Martin and Megan Hennessy of Archaeophone Records. You heard Rich speaking in the plenary session that started off the conference earlier, so you have some familiarity with Archaeophone if you didn't before. But in any case, the project that they have to share with us today is, I think, a very interesting one on a number of levels. There have been a number of efforts to attack early recorded sound en masse, in large quantities, attempting to come close to covering entire catalogs of material as competent, good, reasonable transfers, and so on. And then on the other hand, you have meticulously restored tracks that appear on compilation CDs of various sorts, but somewhat selective, not a great deal of material that really compared to what was available at any time. What really makes this project exciting is it really combines those two things in a very innovative and exciting way, and I'm particularly interested in what they'll have to say about how they're making that work. So, David Giovannoni, Richard Martin, Megan Hennessy, the Blue Amberall at 100.
See, all my fans are here today, all of our fans. The Blue Amberall is a little over 100, but we didn't really get our act together last year. You all know what a Blue Amberall looks like. They're things you throw at the wall or stomp on when you get mad. The Blue Amberall was released in 13?
12.
12, end of 12. And was the last cylinder standing in 1929 when Edison shut down all of the record interests. It's probably the most ubiquitous cylinder out there. And you can pick them up for cheap. In fact, this is how this project started, if I could tell the story. As a collector, I'm out buying record collections, and a few years ago, I found myself, after having bought four or five significant collections with 20,000 cylinders in storage as yet unprocessed, and then when I started processing them, I found that 8,000 of them were these damn Blue Amberalls, and I didn't know exactly what to do with them. I started to assemble them and process them, and I found that two of the five collectors whose collections I had bought after their passing had actually started to put together runs of cylinders. And not just runs, but best copies. And as I put these collections together, I found, still lots of holes, but within the first 1,000 or so in the series, which are all Blue Amberalls worth having, and we'll talk about that in a minute, that there were over 90% of the titles were represented in the collections that I had bought because I really wanted the other cylinders in the collection. I talked to Megan and to Rich about this, and they said, well, let's put them out. Let's see if we can do a complete run. Really, nobody's done that yet. There are several public institutions that are kind of working towards that end. So it was a bit audacious of us to even try. But we started putting them out 30 a month as downloads, and they're still available to you. Let me talk about, so that's the impetus of the project. Let me talk to you about the project itself now. We're going to talk about three things today. First, there are some blue amberols that are worth preserving. And it is not heretical at all to say most are not worth preserving. And I'll explain that to you. You will agree with me at the end. Second, if it's worth preserving, it's worth restoring. It's worth bringing out the sound that is in the grooves of blue amberols. Most blue amberols you've heard today have not been restored. Third, we believe our work, which is privately supported, commercial model, is worth supporting. And we're going to talk to you about that because it's a model that we think complements what the National Recording Preservation Plan assumes, and that is that most preservation will be publicly funded or grant funded. We think that there's this other model that, as we showed during our initial session with Chris and Rich and others at the session, that the commercial reissuers are doing every bit as much and have done much more over the years as publicly funded internet sites and so forth. So those are our three key points today. Let's walk through those. First, worth preserving. Now, it does sound heretical to say that most blue amberols are not worth preserving, but let me explain that to you. We're focused here on the domestic series. Edison's recordings, blue amberol recordings for the domestic U.S. market. He had other series as well. We're going to leave those aside for today. We all do. We all want those. But these are the common blue amberols. For the first couple years of production, from late 1912 to 1914, Edison produced almost all what we call live or direct recordings. These were recordings that were made directly into the horn, into a stylus that cut a cylinder, live to cylinder. Around 1914, Edison had invented the diamond disc, and to save money, Edison said, well, we've got the performance on the diamond disc, let's just dub it to cylinder. Okay, now, if a diamond disc exists today, a commercially reissued diamond disc exists today, that's going to be at least one generation, probably two up, from the best sounding blue amberol. Okay, now, most blue amberols in your collections at institutions are of this type. The question is, are they worth preserving? If you have the disc, which most people do, most discs are not that rare, then you have to answer that question yourselves. I would say, no, absolutely not. The disc will sound better. It's a higher, you know, higher up on the generational chain. These 67% of blue amberol titles in the domestic series are dubbed from commercially available discs. And blue amberol started at 1501 was the first issue number, catalog number. And they go up, what's the highest, Kurt, 5719? 5718. Okay. There was a small series in there, 75, that were for school series, which are exquisitely rare today. But for the most part, every number in between there was an issued title. So of those numbers, about 4,200 titles, 67%. Two out of three of those titles, you can find better copies on the Diamond Discs. So we're focusing on this section here. There are three types of blue amberols that are worth preserving, in our opinion. The first type, Edison reissued from 4-minute wax amberol. This was his format beforehand. He was prohibited legally by pressing in celluloid between 1908 and 1912. And so he pressed in a very brittle wax, metallic wax soap, which wore very quickly. But to get content into this new format in late 12 through 13 and into 14, he was bringing a lot of that old material forward, pressing it in blue amberols and reissuing it. About 9% of the titles fit this description. Then he was recording directly to cylinder for the first time and releasing for the first time on blue amberol. About 16% of the titles in this series fall into that category. Those are probably the best sounding blue amberols, and if so, some of the best sounding cylinder recordings ever made. Now there's another 8% of blue amberols that were dubbed. So you'd say, well, why do we even concern ourselves about those? Well, they're dubbed from unreleased discs. And those discs may or may not exist today, but we've included them, we've embraced them in blue amberols worth preserving, because they may, in fact, be the only record of that performance extant. So when you add those three together, you're looking at about 1 in 3 titles that are worth preserving, and the rest, not so much. Okay? So it's not too heretical to say that some things are more important than others, deserve a much higher priority than others, and are actually worth actively seeking. Rich, you want to talk about the second set and a blue amberol that's worth preserving, we think, is also worth restoring. We'll take questions here at the end. We'll be short.
Yeah, and I'll say a few words about your work in the preservation realm.
Okay, you can do that.
So, as Dave alluded to, he has a vast collection of these. And he's selecting the best copy from among many copies of a given title that he may have. We're not simply taking the first copy, we're taking the best copy. And he is using an Archaophone universal cylinder player to make the transfers. Each transfer is carefully done, squaring the mandrel squaring the cylinder on the mandrel and getting it lined up just right. And he's doing them at archival specifications, 24-bit, 96 kilohertz in stereo. So we have these archival transfers, and they stay that way. We don't do any destructive editing on top of that. So then they come to me, and from there, I'm doing the next step. I'm doing the restoration. So get a little AB here. And here's the very first selection in the series. It's 1501, and it's an orchestral piece. And I go forward more.
You need to explain. This is from.
Okay, so the first thing I'm gonna show you is a raw transfer. This is not one of our own. This is something that you could get online at one of the many places that quite thankfully have been trying to do some of this work, have been making it freely available, which we greatly appreciate their efforts. But you're going to notice there are some problems here And this is the sort of thing that people have faced up till now. You want to listen to the quality of the signal here. Lots of wow and flutter. Seth is dying out here. on a boat. Okay, well, if it's worth preserving, it's also worth restoring. Okay, so we believe that when transferring, the best practice is to make a flat stereo transfer. But we don't believe that a flat restoration is the best practice. So we're working really hard to pull out the infelicities in the low end and then the high end, but then we're EQing to bring out that bass. There's a very rich bass on these Blue Amberols. You have to locate it. And then there's anybody who's ever worked on them, they always have that thump. The plaster of Paris, just it's going to happen. And those have to be pulled out quite judiciously. Well, here's another example. We'll get you a little bit more excited here, hopefully. But here's another example of a raw transfer on another site that you could get for free. Lots of distortion. Yeah, it's worn considerably. It's certainly worth listening to. But if it's worth preserving, it's also worth restoring. Seth, if you got any problems you need fixed, just send them my way.
Same surface noise level, too.
What's that?
Same surface. By the way, if you notice something after it's restored, you can now bring the whole digital level up to something that's listable.
Right. That's right.
You can't record it at that level because you're going to be clipping off all the trains.
That's right. That's right. Well, the last point that we wanted to make was that this is work we believe is worth supporting. Am I doing this one, or you want to do it? we'll tag on it. We have launched this download project that David mentioned, trying to get into that age, reach different kinds of consumers. We've been putting out 30 of these a month, a double album, basically, on iTunes and Google Play and Amazon, and you can still get those. We'll have 12 volumes available. But if you want to wait, you can, at the end of the year, we hope to have ready volume one of the physical series, which will be about 500 tracks on about 30 CDs in a little box. You're going to keep it very kind of archival, a little bit lighter on the literature, which we have been making available freely on our website to go along with the download series. One of the things we have found from our customer base is that they are still very much dedicated to physical product. We're trying to answer that need as well as the need of those who want downloadable product. We think this is something that's going to be very attractive to archives and libraries. One thing that we hope we are achieving in this series is that we've done it for you. If you've got a big collection of these, we hope that you will not find it necessary to do your own transfers because we're doing them for you. And we believe that the sound that we're accomplishing is going to be better than you'll have, that you'll have time for, let's put it that way. So it's ready to go. So, the Blue Amber All at 100, worth preserving, worth restoring, and worth supporting. Thank you very much.
Questions, Jay? Yeah.
So the question was pretty straightforward. Outside of the unreleased on disc, do these fall into a numerical range?
Yes.
How many are you looking for? And are you advertising?
We spent an hour and 40 minutes this morning looking for a chart that I prepared that shows you what, it lays out the numerical range, and we, it just wasn't on our servers where we thought it was. Everything from 1501 to 2500, the first 1,000, there's only one in there that's from a dubbed released disc.
How about the foreign ones?
How about them?
You know, I want them. Where are they?
Well, here's the thing, Chris. Support us on this, and then we'll do the hard stuff. Okay, this is the easy stuff.
Well, do you know they exist?
Yes, we do. They exist all over the place.
Really?
Yeah. Name the series for me. There's
Mexican. I want the Spanish series.
The Spanish series, Mexican series. There's a Cuban series. There's what else, Bill?
No, I don't want none of the rest. Just the Cuban and Mexican.
Yeah. Okay, well, Chris, we're going to work on that for you then. Tim?
You mentioned correctly that the dubs are a generation or two beyond the discs. However, the issued discs of the teens, the Black Label, are notorious for their poor sound quality. Even Edison joked about them in that famous dealer thing. So can you get better sound, do you think, out of one of those poorly pressed discs than you can out of a cylinder?
Yes, you can get better sound out of a pristine cylinder dub than you can out of a typically crummy World War I era disc. But our belief is that there are good pressings out there still of those discs, either later or a disc that didn't, early pressings, discs that didn't suffer the physical, mechanical deterioration that they have. And Jerry's got a whole bunch of master stampers at the site, excuse me, the park, the Thomas Edison National Historical Park, that he's working on getting transferred as well. So your point is very well taken, and I think we've been guilty of using cylinder transfers of some discs in their work, but for that very reason. But somewhere, someplace, these things probably exist in better form. Rob?
You've been very explicit about what you mean by worth preserving and worth restoring, but not so explicit about the form of support that you may be seeking.
To be honest, the Archiphone Archives, which is the label or sublabel,
imprint,
I'm not up on the lingo. Archiphone Archives is the imprint under which we've been releasing these as digital downloads only. This is the first Archiphone product that does not have physical product. It's not been a gangbusting success. So, and Rich said why. His clients want his physical product. So,
and a number of them. Also, yeah, and some of the archives are coming up to us saying, we want these. We're buying them for the time being, but please tell us you're going to put them on physical media so we can get something a little more permanent and also get the full wave quality.
Oh, okay, I did understand that. I thought you were looking for support in kind of an underwriting.
No, we're going to put out a
if
brick.
If you have an offer.
Yeah. We're going to put out a brick, 30 CDs. I don't know. We haven't priced it yet, but, you know, what do 30 CDs cost in a brick? It's not a lot of money for the amount of music that you're getting. Buy it, for crying out loud. Don't steal it. Put it in your libraries. Put it in your archives. Make it available to people you serve or put it in your own collection. Because if we can't sell out the first couple thousand units of that, there won't be volume two. That's what I'm, let me be very clear and crass. Buy the stuff. Support us. Thank you.
Perhaps my problem is I think too much like a public radio person.
There you go. Perhaps that's mine too.
Among the unreleased cylinders, typically the Edison discs release multiple takes of multiple performances. Are there instances where the cylinders contain material that are otherwise unreleased on published recordings?
On published recordings, we haven't found it yet. And in fact, I'll let you in on a secret. The dots that we used to believe indicated take don't indicate take. And we haven't written this up yet. But it's more complicated than that. I have been comparing takes A-B, playing one live while listening to a recorded one, I mean, absolutely simultaneously. And there's only one instance in the first 500 in the series, only one instance where there is a significant difference in the performance. And that's when Joe Hines, when Hughes, in one says that he's from Truckamuck, and the other he's from...
It was the state. It was Georgia versus...
North Carolina. But it was the same routine. It was, I mean, almost verbatim, word for word, delivered exactly the same, and yet in one he's from Truckamuck, and the other he's from Georgia. So there are... We have found... Edison's folks demanded consistency from take to take is what we suspect. Now, when you get into the 20s and the jazz stuff, that's a whole different deal, but that's not where we are yet. George.
No, you're granting the right one. I strongly endorse this idea that if you're doing it, then nobody else has to do it, and you're doing it well enough so that there's not a question of whether somebody should do it. The one thing I do have a concern about is whether, because it's worth restoring, there's such a high subjectivity level mm-hmm. with that. And although the examples you played sound wonderful, are you going to make the unrestored flat or unprocessed transfers available?
We haven't talked about that. We maintain them. We have servers that are the equal of most institutions, actually. When I make a transfer, it goes off-site that night. It sits on in a TDR. It goes up to their house the following day. So we have multiple off-site locations. We're running RAID arrays. I mean, it's going to be...
The secret is out.
It's going to be there. Now, the question is, it's really their decision from a business perspective whether to let the archival transfers out, the 2496 flat stereos out? And if so, when to do that? I don't know that I would do it before this product has broken even. Then the other question is, who are we going to give it to or sell it to, and what are they going to do with it? Because I agree 100%. It's the archive series. The transfers are going to be very hard to beat for a very long time. Seth.
Address that right now.
Dave is using Capstan to get the stability. That's right. It's tough with the vocals. Capstan's not really meant to do that. So we're cheating here and there to get the results.
It's because of the instability
of the voice itself. That's right. I'm using a variety of tools. I use Waves and Isotope RX and SoundForge and some other stuff. The things that have been most useful for this type of media have been the Waves Decrackler and the Isotope RX variety of functions. The declicker they've got is terrific. Spectral repair is very much like your retouch, which I use quite a bit. They've got a deconstruct function, which is unbelievable. The bottom end, like I said earlier, has got, you know, the thump over and over and over and over again. And that, you know, I have to take that bottom and really kind of clean it out. I don't eliminate it, so it still has texture and depth there. But SoundForge is one of them. Gary.
Is the pitch instability an inherent problem in his recording process, or is it a result of physical deformity over time?
It's the latter. We've not found any blue amberol perfectly, that is still perfectly true, that we can play back perfectly true on the Archiphone mandrel, you know, after you make all the correct adjustments, which, by the way, a number of these, you know, online sources didn't really seem to pay a lot of attention to. Because they're all, but we've never found one perfectly in like mint condition, perfectly transferred, where there's any speed instabilities, wow or flutter burned in. Not to say it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. We hear it on early discs all the time. We know what to listen for. The blue amberols seem to have been recorded on a very reliable, true lathe. The mechanical problems come from the swelling of the plaster of Paris, the cracking of the plaster of Paris, it deforms the celluloid. All sorts of things, bad things happen to these things. A lot of it can be corrected on the mandrel of the Archaeophone because of the adjustments. And most of my time is spent adjusting, not transferring. Yes. Blue amberol that might play like this, you know, as it turns. Well, if you can make the mandrel do that, then the blue amberol is nice and true. Yeah, there's all sorts of adjustments you can make.
Can I ask you one other thing? Have you hit any where there were skip grooves or repeated grooves?
All the time. When we have a less than nice copy, yes, that happens.
How do you get around it?
Play it backwards. Oh, that's another way, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Sure, there's all sorts of tricks. I can show you a trick I do with a pencil. There's all sorts of things. Everybody's got a trick. We're getting hooked off the stage here. So
maybe one more.
Okay, Brad.
I'm wondering if you have any familiarity with the cylinder playback system that the Phonogram Archive is using in Vienna, and whether that might work any better for this for these issues.
Is that the one with the big acoustical horn? No. Okay. Bill says it's probably no better, and if Bill says that, I believe it. Okay, okay. He knows. Others? Good. Thank you.
Thank you.